between President Emeritus Frederick L. Hovde and R.B. Eccles Department of History. It's for the Purdue University Archives. It's recorded on August the 30th, 1972 in the offices of the President Emeritus. Well, we have got a lot of topics this morning. Let's start out with the topic of faculty relations while you were president.
Well, the purpose, the main purposes of a university being teaching and research and public service that is related to education and scholarly work and research. It follows that the people who do the work are the most important people who do the work are the faculty. Faculty, of course, consists of those who have teaching assignments in the schools of the university, and those who have research assignments, and those who do both. Faculty, as an organized group of people, is given certain powers with respect to university management. And these powers are prescribed by the trustees. And are reserved to the organized faculty or faculty government, which is the organizational structure composed of faculty members, organized to discharge their responsibilities under the code of the university. Historically, the president of the university is not only its chief administrative officer, but is also named as the head of the faculty organization, whatever form that may take. The form of faculty government or organization for carrying out the responsibilities of faculty government at Purdue went through about four successive changes during my administration. When I came to succeed President Elliott in 1946, the university was much smaller than it is today, and the faculty met as a entire body under the chairmanship of the president to conduct its business. At some of these early meetings, there were as many as 400 members of the faculty present at these meetings. Faculty committees were generally appointed to exercise the, to carry out the functions. Functions and responsibilities being related first to the calendar of the university, and second, the curriculum or curricula of the university, requirements for the degrees, degrees granted to students who completed a prescribed course of study is set by the faculty and approved by the administration and trustees. As the university grew in size, complexity, from time to time during my administration, select committees of the faculty were appointed to revise the organizational structure from one in which the faculty met as a whole to a representative form of faculty governance in which the governing body was the Faculty Senate, an elected group with proportional representation of the schools and divisions of the university. Furthermore, as the professional schools of the university grew, certain matters which were related to, primarily related to curriculum requirements, curricular requirements, were quite properly the province of each separate professional school under its dean. And matters which of this kind, which involved one of the schools of the university, which did not impinge on the rest of the university in any significant way, were essentially reserved to the faculty of the particular school involved. In recent years, there has been a pronounced trend on the part of organized faculty members.
You're referring to such things as the AAUP?
Yes, and not only that, but groups of faculty interested in the management of the university. There had been a trend on the part of the organized faculty for a greater voice in the management functions of the university, greater participation in the administrative functions, the budgetary functions, the rulemaking functions with respect to many matters which relate to the external world, many matters which relate to the student body and student life, and in general, boards of trustees and presidents have not been willing to vest more power in the faculty with respect to many of these areas of management. Primarily, I believe, because the faculty, organized faculty groups operate generally through committees and by the functioning of the so-called democratic method, which everybody has their say, in which all actions are eventually compromises of one kind and another within the corporate structure of the institution. But in any event, decisions are hard to come by and they're difficult for committees and groups of people to reach and to make. The trustees have not been willing to transfer the basic power of management of the university and then themselves be held accountable for what happens.
Well, in the sense, they can't do it under law, can they?
And in a real sense, of course, they can't transfer their responsibility. They can transfer and assign responsibility to carry out trustee policy and trustee rules and regulations with respect to the management of the university to others, as they do, to the president and his staff, to the treasurer and his staff, to the faculty as an organized body. But the trustees, in the end, are the accountable body to the body politic.
In short, the buck stops with the trustees.
Well, there is a higher authority than the trustees, namely the legislature for all state universities. And the moment the state university is mismanaged, then legislature steps in, always. Because it becomes a matter of the mismanagement of public funds as appropriated by the legislature. Legislators. Some of the clamor and demand on the part of the faculty for greater voice has been met. To varying degrees in various different kinds of institutions. Mechanisms have been set up for easier forms of communication between the trustees and the faculty by the appointment of liaison officers representing the faculty to the trustees, who are permitted to attend the trustees' meeting, permitted to speak, although not to vote. Presumably, faculty believes that someone other than the president can speak for them more effectively with the trustees, when actually, in practice, over the years, as I've observed it, the best spokesmen for the faculty have been the presidents. The most effective spokesmen for the faculties have been the presidents. One would expect this because that president who wants a top-flight university must recruit and maintain a top-flight faculty, otherwise he has nothing. When one looks at the history of universities, not only in this country, but in other countries, European, South American, Oriental, one observation becomes quite clear, namely that those institutions which have given the power of management to the university to the faculties have never had steady histories of great performance and effective performance. And those universities who have granted similar powers to the student body have never been particularly significant in the world of higher education. It just hasn't worked. I think that the growth and development of the American universities in the 20th century has been the envy of the world. In terms of providing the open opportunity to train its citizens to perform the professional tasks and services needed by all the people of a nation. It's interesting, too, that for many years our friends in England looked down their noses at the American higher educational system. And then after the war, They paid us the great compliment of imitating many
of... the creation of the new universities, such as Sussex, Canterbury...
With the creation of new institutions to serve the needs of the British people. Oxford and Cambridge, the great English universities. Did the magnificent job for a small number of people over a number of centuries and represented the acme of the university world. But the needs, the educational needs of the nation extend across the spectrum, vastly greater than the small portion of the spectrum that Oxford and Cambridge served. Oxford and Cambridge, of course, received government subvention, and of course were wealthy in terms of the accumulation of gifts, trusts over centuries of existence. And they had their choice of the leading faculty members in the British Isles, simply because that represented the acme of the profession of teaching in the universities. But a similar development did not occur in this country. And our country's system of higher education is characterized by an enormous diversity. Diversity of post-high school institutions, small and large, public and private, many with denominational backgrounds, religious interests, Episcopal and Methodist and Catholic and Baptist and Mormon and you name it. A small private college, the liberal arts college, both public, most of them private, represents the largest number of specific kinds of colleges in this country. I suppose there are an order of 1,200 such colleges. Most of them small in numbers, ranging between 400 students to maybe 2,000 or 3,000 students.
As one of my colleagues has recently...
But the phenomena, the most interesting developmental phenomena in American higher education was the tremendous growth and development on all fronts of the so-called state universities. The quality institutions in this country for many years, say from 1850 to 1920, were the large, great, older private universities represented by Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Cornell, University of Chicago, Stanford. In the north and west, central and west, and in the south by maybe Vanderbilt, Tulane, in Texas by Rice Institute. But following World War I, the decade of the 20s and 30s, the major state universities of the Midwest and the Far West began to grow and develop into great universities, challenging on every front the older reputations of the great private institutions. University of California at Berkeley, University of Minnesota, University of Wisconsin, University of Michigan, University of Indiana, University of Washington. Were the state institutions that began to flourish and challenge the leading universities of the world during the decade of the 20s and 30s. This was a great growth period for the state universities, and in this period, Purdue as a state university, a land-grant university, grew also. One of the interesting developments that, one of the interesting factors that played an important part in World War II, which was a war in which science was mobilized on all the scientific fronts to fight this war against Nazi Germany. What came out of the mobilization of science and the application of science and technology to warfare was that this country, through its higher educational system, had the capacity and had produced sufficient numbers of people out of the public universities in particular to meet the needs of the scientific war. And the conclusion of World War II was perfectly clear that science, both pure and applied, had a tremendous role to play in the future of all nations and their development. And thus, the phenomenon of, well, Van Bush's book called The Endless Frontier was published by Van Bush. Science, The Endless Frontier, was published, written and published by Van Bush right after World War II. And this set the stage for the development of massive government support for the sciences, creation of the National Science Foundation, the expansion and development of the National Institutes of Health. And by 1950, the federal government was embarked on a program of sponsoring and supporting science, pure sciences in the universities, and applied sciences and industry, to provide all the things that the society needed and wanted, which they could have, as was demonstrated by the productivity and the new things that came out of science during World War II. So the university science establishment received a tremendous boost in support, move forward on all fronts in the years immediately following World War II.
What was the effect of
And, of course, Purdue, being a land-grant university, was, with its professional schools all being all requiring basic science and applied science, Purdue was a university almost entirely devoted to professional education based on science. Engineering, of course, is mathematics and chemistry and physics. Agriculture is the biological, applied biological sciences across the whole gamut of the life sciences, both plant and animal. Pharmacy is biology and chemistry. Veterinary medicine, home economics. These professional schools all were science-oriented, science-based. And hence the basic science departments at Purdue were large and very, very important elements in the total Purdue total Purdue missions, and consequently the development of the four major science departments, physics, mathematics, chemistry, and the biological sciences, was a high priority item at Purdue University. Actually, the four major science departments have under daily instruction on this campus, and have had for a number of years, the largest number of people, daily or weekly attendance, classroom attendance, of any institution in the world here in this small town of Montpelier, Indiana. With this development also grew the graduate school expanded, because of course the period of training required for scientists, both pure and applied, required graduate work. 4 years, typical undergraduate program was, and not sufficient in breadth or depth. And hence the decade of the 50s and 60s saw Purdue University grow and develop as a scientific institution. And as a companion institution to Indiana University, which historically had a set of professional schools, law, medicine, dentistry, journalism, music, which are not duplicated at Purdue. Engineering and agriculture and pharmacy and veterinary medicine were located at Purdue, also home economics, whereas the other professions, law, journalism and so forth, were at the State University in Bloomington. So there was a sharp division of professional interest historically. Not necessarily by design, but by fortunate happenstance over the years that followed the creation of Purdue University as the land-grant institution in 1869. Now, professionals, scientists and engineers, both pure and applied, are also people, and they have to work within the social and political structure. And so, of course, at Purdue, I gave a high priority to the development of the humanities and the social sciences, since these disciplines were part of the reason why we were interested in science. We wanted a more perfect society, a happier society, a more effective society, and presumably the whole purpose of science is to help man make life better and easier and happier and longer for all people in the society. And of course, concomitant with the development of Purdue science, pure and applied, we saw great development in the humanities and social sciences. Which is a story in itself. I don't know why I got off on this historical treatment.
Well, we, I think, have part of it in another section.
Oh, I was talking about the management of university.
You were talking about the management. It's perfectly natural to get into this.
Yeah, well, I'm talking about the management, the faculty and the student demand for participation.
May I ask a question at this point? I'm just wondering, as you were talking, what was the effect of Sputnik on Purdue faculty and its direction? Was there any way
Not so much on the Purdue faculty and so on, but Sputnik had a tremendous effect nationally, because it dramatically demonstrated the fact that the Russians and the Russian system, educational system, was good enough to put the first satellite in orbit, and they weren't to be taken lightly in terms of the competition that always exists between nations. And it called for a look-see at our high school system, our curriculum in the high school, its breadth and depth. And Sputnik was a stimulus to the educational system of the country, particularly in the sciences again. And this became evident during the decade of the 60s, when the high schools showed such marked improvement in instruction in the sciences and mathematics, particularly. So much so that most of the state universities, by 1960 or 65, had dropped all those courses which were repetitive high school courses. Now, with the disadvantaged students coming on, the universities are returning to offering refresher high school courses for those that come on into the university scene without adequate preparation from the high schools. Well, the demand for participation, part of the faculty and part of the students in university governance, was an element, of course, in the turmoil that was generated on the campuses in the period 1965 to 1970. And of course, the structure of the population has changed as a result of World War II and the increased birth rate. The changing structure of the population in terms of age groups, increasing numbers of young, increasing numbers of old, the elderly, and these social phenomena have their direct effects in the political scene and the social scene. Other factors in recent years that have caused great change in the general environment of the nation, the attitude of its citizens, or of course the Vietnamese War, long and drawn out, with seemingly no end. A new and developing interest in the protection of the environment, which began in the early 60s. A great new interest on the part of the younger people in the political process. And of course, the politicians, conversely, the politicians being interested in the vote, the successful drive of the younger people to get the voting rights by 18 instead of 21.
Is all of this reflected in the demand for student involvement in
all of these factors?
I would think so.
Impinge one way or another upon the university. And of course the manifestations of this was newsworthy. An outward manifestation of many of these problems was violence. Of course, all of this being complicated by the Supreme Court rulings on affecting the educational system and the educational opportunities of our black people. So, in the decade of the 60s, we saw a whole series of societal changes which generated a great deal of heat. A great deal of heat.
You want to speculate about how much light?
Well, a good deal of light, too. I mean, the interest in environmental protection is eminently sensible.
Absolutely.
The lowering of the voting age is eminently sensible. Doing away with discrimination, the attempts to solve this problem, the integration of the blacks into our society is a vastly better now than it was. The ecumenical movement in the religious world is one of the very significant developments, again triggered by all the social changes.
You find that students have changed fundamentally very great deal?
Well, when you say fundamentally, I mean the human animal doesn't change fundamentally under in the course of one or two or three generations. Any change that occurs in the human animal, it changes over thousands of years.
The same kind of people go to school now as they did, to university now as they did when
More go. I mean, you serve a greater spectrum. You have community colleges and junior college systems, which have had tremendous growth. What happens is that in a modern complex society, the high school education proves not to be enough. Furthermore, the fruit of technological advance is surcease from work, and so you cut off the workers at both the lower and the higher ends of the age spectrum. You delay the entry of people into the workforce by extending education one, two, three, four more years beyond high school, and you cut off the other end by retiring people more early. And this is one of the results of multiplying man's effectiveness with machines and energy. And this is the fruit of technology and science. Didn't one of the fruits. Surcease from work.
Yeah, Clark Carr, did he say that by 1980, most of the work done could be done through computerization and so on, but could be done by people with only high school educations?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that's true. I don't think he said that.
I heard him say something very much like that over here in his address. He said that the ordinary work could be done by people with high school educations, and therefore the service that the university would give to the community would have to be an extension into community colleges, junior colleges, and so on. And even the nature of the curriculum might be changed by this.
Well, I think he was talking about the very simple fact that educational opportunity and so on has to be where people live.
Taking the university to the people.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's what he was talking about. But post-high school education now to do almost all the jobs that, except menial labor, require some kind of special training. Indeed, the American industry sponsors an educational training program for its entrants, new workers, that is simply gigantic in both numbers and dollars and teachers and all the rest of it. Well, what we've seen happen in the last 10 years poses new demands on the ability of our people to manage national affairs. Keep the economy viable and strong, provide jobs, stop the destruction of the environment, natural environment, remove discrimination, stop wars. New requirements are will put strains on not only the universities, but also the governmental organization of the nation. And events of the last year seem to indicate that the great powers are truly not interested in World War III. Chinese and the Russians, ourselves, show evidence that they're not warlike, not interested in starting a Holocaust. They seem to be more receptive to living together in this globe. At least that's a hope.
You think we've shown much interest in the United States?
In what?
Living peacefully with other people?
Oh, I think so.
I don't think there's any question of it.
Well, I have always felt that my relationships with the faculty were always very good. I made it a personal policy never to interfere in any way with the faculty prerogatives. Conversely, I always held that the faculty could not interfere with my assigned duties and prerogatives.
Excuse me, may we go off the side and turn over to the side, please? We'll go to side B now. All right, this is side B of our interview on August the 30th.
I think most of my thinking about the university was dictated by a deep-seated belief that the university as an organization, a corporate organization, simply had to conduct its affairs as an example. Everything the university did ought to be done with excellence in mind. And its entire purposes were constructive. And whenever individuals and groups and so on wanted to relax standards and the demands that an achievement of excellence imposes upon people and organizations, I was always against this kind of relaxation. Furthermore, I think the problems of society are now more difficult and place greater demands upon all the professionals. And the relaxation of educational requirements, of educational performance, not necessarily requirements, on the part of students, I think is nonsense.
Very real sense, it's a tougher world than it was 40 years ago.
Tougher world to cope with intellectually.
That it is.
You can cope with it as far as basic existence is concerned because we don't let anybody starve. The welfare system sees to it that everybody has enough to eat and a place to sleep. Well, Purdue's relationships with the state legislature over the years were in the main good. The move I made in the early 50s with Herman Wells to join forces with Indiana University and the two then state teachers' colleges in working out a formula for the division of appropriated support money from the legislature. It led to some very, very interesting and constructive relationships between the four state institutions, and a long period of very successful and happy relationships with the legislature.
You made it a team effort.
It was a team effort. And we allowed and we worked out methods whereby the division of the appropriated money was a fair division and not subject to personal desires, or the aggrandizement of one institution at the expense of another.
Would you say that's the case now? Or do you want to comment?
Well, four state institutional cooperation was ended in the Brannigan administration. While he, in insisted that each institution submit its own budget according to and ask for its legislative appropriation to support programs. One never could quite understand, because the governor's office and the state budget director's office had no staff to even read or look at the programs prior to the legislature. And the legislature and its membership had no concept of how to look at the programs, how to study them, how to examine them, how to support them. So the situation deteriorated in the Brannigan regime. But on the whole, in the decade of the 50s and 60s, one must say that the legislature was good to the state higher educational system. It was good in this sense, that over that long haul of two decades, just about 30% of the general fund, regardless of total amount, was appropriated for higher education. And as the state income grew, the appropriations grew. The state economy grew, state income grew, and 30% of an increased number meant increases in support monies for the state units of higher education. Indiana as a state did not lead the states in support for higher education, neither did it bring up the rear. It was
a comfortable middle position.
It was a middle position. And with that kind of support and with the other forms of support available to Purdue, I think that Purdue's position and reputation in the hierarchy of American universities was recognized by election to the American Association of Universities, the AAU, in 1956. First separated land-grant institution that was invited into that association. That association of 40 universities fancies itself as the 40 best, based on the 40 best universities in terms of their graduate programs and their research programs. And Purdue was the first of the separated land-grant universities. Separated land-grant universities means that the land-grant university is separated from the state university. University of Minnesota is both the state university and the land-grant university. University of Illinois is both the state university and the land-grant university. But institutions like Oregon State, Oklahoma State University, Michigan State University, Purdue, were separated land-grant universities, or separate institutions.
When I asked about the students, I think that we had, at the end of the war, the best students I've ever had, right at the end, when the vets came back from World War II.
Well, the period 46, 47, and 48.
They were a different breed.
Well, they were older and more mature, and they'd fought their war anywhere from 1 to 5 years.
And they knew what they wanted.
And they were married, many of them. They wanted to finish their education and get into their peacetime careers. So they had motivation and age and maturity and experience behind them.
But the students today have gone back to the kind that we had before.
They come out of high schools.
Yeah.
Very little work experience behind them. In an affluent society.
Of course, we have one breed of student here that I don't see that you don't see in many liberal arts colleges, and that's the keen, intelligent kid who's been brought up on an Indiana farm or neighboring farm and who's been helping using his dad's capital to increase his own capital and make his way. He is a different kind of student that I've encountered here from, let us say, that you find at IU or the small liberal arts college.
Well, true
enough.
He's
a good boy. I like him.
Well, the farm family in Indiana has progressed to a point where you can't differentiate them very much from the city family or the small town family.
In one sense, that's true, but these kids have been
very good. I mean, the consolidation of the high schools has proceeded to a point where all the youngsters who live on farms go to high schools that are just as good as the city schools.
Not better, from the point of view.
And some of them are better.
Yep.
Purdue's relationships with the private institutions has been good. Following World War II, Herman Wells and I met with all the private college presidents. And as a result of the birth rate of the war, we knew that, wartime, we knew that the numbers entering our institutions would grow dramatically. We had a 10 or 12 year advance notice, and we simply challenged all the private institutions to start then to plan to double their enrollments. Because we made it perfectly clear to them that if they didn't, the burden would fall on the state universities. So we worked with the private institutions on along this line to stimulate them to expand. And many of them did. But at any rate, our relationships with them were always good. Indeed, we worked together on many, many programs which were sponsored through the organization known as the Indiana Conference on Higher Education, which consisted of the four state institutions plus about 30 private institutions in Indiana. I'm not sure that we should discuss any more of the sciences at Purdue or the various disciplines. Founding of the School of Veterinary Science and Medicine was an interesting story. The head of our veterinary science department, Dr. Pat Hutchins, was a remarkable man. Fine scientist, fine speaker, fine politician, leader, and much well respected by the veterinary medical people, both practicing, and both those in practice and those in the educational scene. Indiana was one of the states without a school of veterinary medicine. In fact, I think there were only 18 in the country at the time, 18 schools of veterinary medicine. Our department had been a small teaching department related to the School of Agriculture, and its interest in animal science, and a research department sponsored with supported with funds from the Agricultural Experiment Station. There are about 500 practicing veterinarians in Indiana. The age spectrum of this group of professionals was heavily toward the older side, and many of them had been graduated from the early days when there were a great many proprietary schools of veterinary medicine, which grew up throughout the country in the days when horses were so important as economic power on the farms. The whole farming economy depended upon horses until the tractor came in, and then the horse died out. But working with the profession, we generated a proposal to establish School of Veterinary Science and Medicine. And by and large, the profession supported the development of the vet school. There were a small group who were violently opposed. Over a six-year period, in three biennial sessions of the legislature, we submitted the formal legislation to establish the School of Veterinary Science and Medicine with the requisite appropriations, one, to build the buildings and equip them, and the operating funds. First time, there was a general refusal on the part of the legislature to act. Second session, there was some interest and expressions that they would establish, pass the legislation, but wouldn't appropriate the money. And I said that under no circumstances would we establish a school unless it was completely funded.
In other words, if you're
under Handley's, you're going to have a school, you're going to have one.
Do it right.
Do it right. And then under third time, under Governor Handley, the legislation was passed, special capital appropriation enough to build the entire structure was passed, and the school was started. And students admitted, and before the first class received their degrees, the school was accredited by the American Veterinary Medical Association. But it was an example of a creation of a professional school that was started right, and by doing it that way, it cost you less, because the University of Minnesota had started a veterinary medical school some years before. And the Minnesota legislature had given them enough money for only half the buildings they needed. And 10 years later, they didn't even have the second half yet. They started on a shoestring, and they remained on a shoestring, whereas I started full-fledged with all the buildings and equipment. From the day it opened its doors. And that investment made back in those days in terms of dollars was very, very small compared to the cost today. And in the meantime, we've had the use of it for all. The development of the Krannert School, of course, was a special story, too. Dr. Weiler came to us from the University of Illinois to head the Department of Economics. And the curriculum was set up in the old School of Science, called Industrial Economics. There were a great many students who came to Purdue who thought they might want to be engineers, but really wanted careers in industry, but not as engineers. And so there were a great many students who took industrial economics. And then it became apparent that one of the new important areas of academic development serving American industry was the whole field of quantitative economics, the whole field of the application of the computer to business management, the scientific attack on all elements of the productive relationship of machine and man, and energy and capital to make things. And so the School of Industrial Management was formed. School of Industrial Management then was a school where the interest was primarily in the training of people to man the productive industries in contradistinction to those who man the service industries, like banks and insurance companies and retailing.
I remember talking to the dean of the IU Business School, and he was very perturbed and upset by it. He didn't believe it.
Well, it didn't matter what he thought and believed. Our problem here was not being met by the typical business schools, and we had an enormous interest, an entree into American industry through our engineering schools.
It would be ridiculous not to use it.
And so, Mr. Craner, Indianapolis philanthropist, had become acquainted with Dean Wyler through some special training program for some of the inland container personnel that Dean Wyler and his staff worked out for them. And then Kreiner became interested in supporting the development of the graduate program in industrial administration, building on the School of Industrial Management, and provided a major gift to the university, support monies, to be utilized to support all those programs which would make the school first class, yet couldn't be supported by state appropriated funds. The structure was built in the School of Industrial Management. In 10 years' time, became one of the top 10 in the country. This was a growth and development as fast as it can be achieved.
Couldn't have been much faster.
Success story that was maximized.
No question.
Early on in the history of the university in the David Ross era, Ross became interested in aviation and foresaw its role in the transportation field. And he was instrumental in purchasing the land and giving the university its airport. The University Airport, the first of its kind in the country. Ross and Elliott promoted the coming of Amelia Earhart to train here prior to her ill-fated round-the-world flight. Early on, a curriculum in air transportation was developed, mainly cooperation with the engineering schools. A curriculum far in advance of its time. So much so that the airlines, which were developing themselves and having tremendous struggles and development, weren't interested enough to hire the graduates. Development of post-high school technical training courses took place at the airport, and it also was the home of the School of Aeronautical Engineering. Technical training program, aviation technology was flourished, but limited. And the provision of aircraft and flight experience to students, a very expensive proposition. Purdue Aeronautics Corporation was chartered about 1940 to manage the airport and handle the problems, all the problems involved in flying aircraft. Charter flight operations were set up to help defray the costs of flying aircraft for the students. The entry into charter operations was accomplished by the Purdue Aeronautics Corporation by getting two crash damaged DC-3s and rebuilding them and putting them into service. And when the supplemental air carriers were certificated by the Congress, the FAA, and the Civil Aeronautics Board, Purdue Aeronautics Corporation was one of 13 supplemental airlines. Purdue Aeronautics Corporation developed the airport, was very active during the World War II days when the airport served as a naval instructor's training site. Of course, the airport turned out then to be a great asset to the community, since it serves the Tippecanoe County area. At one time there was great to-do raised by the people that the university should not be in the airport business and flight business, compete with other airlines and so on. And so I offered the Purdue University Airport to the county and the city, and they wouldn't take it.
I remember that.
From that time on, there had been no trouble. When the jet age arrived, it became obvious that Purdue Aeronautics Corporation, which was a not-for-profit corporation, couldn't raise money and couldn't finance the purchase of jet aircraft. Couldn't get the necessary permits to fly the Caribbean area and Canadian and Mexican routes, serving contiguous areas to the continental United States. So we sold our certificate to Mr. Jackson Stevens, a Little Rock, Arkansas investment banker, who wanted to get in the airline business. DC jet aircraft, Douglas jet aircraft were purchased. He had the capital to put in to develop, buy the airplanes. But to his entry into the airline business came just at the time when there was a real recession in the airline business. Finally, Mr. Stevens has sold the certificate and has gotten out. But the programs at the airport go forward. In aviation technology and aviation electronics, in the School of Aeronautics, astronautics, aeronautical engineering. And in the sale of the certificate, enough money was acquired by the university to redo the Purdue University Airport, and work is going on now, extending and enlarging the runways and making general improvements to the airport. With the advent of this improvement program and the construction of a FAA tower, Purdue University Airport will be a fine service facility for Purdue and this community, because the only access to Lafayette public travel access is by air. All the trains have disappeared. And you can get bus service, of course, but air travel is the only public transportation link to the outside world. So it's vital to the welfare of the university, as well as the community. And the airport has had fine financial management and is financially viable. One other major organization in the state with which the university has had fine relationships through the years is with the Indiana Farm Bureau. Indiana Farm Bureau organization, of course, represents 120,000 farm families in the state. A very powerful organization. Purdue's relationships have always been cordial with this organization. Farm Bureau has supported Purdue School of Agriculture and the Experiment Station, and the state chemist and the regulatory functions assigned to the state chemist. It's been a happy mutual arrangement of mutual support. Relationships with the press of the state have been good, with a single exception of the Indianapolis Star. There was a period of a couple of years when the Star, for no apparent reason, at least I could never generate a reason for the attacks on the university by the Star. But over a period of a couple of years, the Star was constantly attacking Purdue, but never had anything to attack that meant anything to the public.
I remember one occasion, a lot of publicity was given to a labor leader who said that he, of all people, attacked Red Mackey and the athletic program. Remember that episode? And it was given big headlines in the Star, and it said we were spending public money for useless activities in the stadium. Red came back and said that showed him that this was supported by tickets and not by taxpayers' funds. I think that was the, I remember that episode particularly. I remember other episodes. I don't read the Star very often.
But that passed over, and after that passage of that particular episode, the Star has not been an enthusiastic supporter of Purdue University, but it hasn't attacked the university in any meaningful way. Of great help to us in this period was, of course, the Lafayette Journal Courier, then owned and operated by Federated Newspapers, now part of the Gannett newspaper chain, but assigned to Lafayette was Jack Scott, who was editor and publisher of the Lafayette Journal Courier, and Jack Scott was a interesting journalist and manager and deeply interested in the university. The only, prior to coming to Lafayette, he was living in South Bend, was the only Republican mayor who was ever elected in South Bend, tribute to the man. And he rallied to our help the time the Star was attacking us, all the other newspapers, and a great many of the other newspapers in the state. And Scott was very, very instrumental in helping us with our newspaper relationships during meetings of the General Assembly, prior to and during the legislative years. The university owes a debt to Jack Scott for his interest and help, which was constant and effective over all the years that he was here. Charge of our local newspaper.
This is the end of the interview on August 30th for the Purdue University Archives.